It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking about the ways that natural science illustration can make us more attentive, help us with our observational skills, and help us more carefully study the natural world. I have with me some artists from the Finger Lakes District, and we'll get our audience familiar with what that is and where that is in just a minute. But I wanted to introduce Elizabeth Morales, who's president of the Finger Lakes chapter of the Guild of Natural Science Illustrators. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
And Lucille Francis Gagliaro and who's an illustrator. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I've got Stefan DeCerbo, who's another illustrator. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you.
And I've got Francis Fawcett, who's also an illustrator. Welcome, Francis. So I wanted to start out first, Finger Lakes. So those of us that know about New York know what you're talking about, but who wants to jump in and give us a little description of where you are and where you work kind of in that area?
Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, call on you.
Right on the lake.
I think, Lucy, you've lived here longer than anyone in the Finger Lakes. There are, a dozen Finger Lakes in the region? I don't know what some of the larger ones are more well-known than some of the smaller, so I'm not sure what the actual count is. But they're in central New York. They run north-south, Cayuga Lake and Seneca Lake being the two largest. I know Cayuga Lake, which is where I live, runs around 40 miles north, 40 miles long, and about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles wide. So they're quite considerable lakes. A glacier created by the glaciers way back when, and support a wonderful variety of animals and plants that we focused on in many of our shows because we're here on the Finger Lakes.
That's great. That's a great description. And so people get a sense, each of those lakes is a little bit different too, in its composition, both naturally, as well as where it is within the state. So that makes the diversity for you all as illustrators pretty broad in that area.
Absolutely.
Area. Partly because it was a plateau that was carved by the and carved out as the glaciers receded. Gorges, the lakes formed, and as the rivers led down into the lakes, they carved beautiful gorges through the plateau, and all these lakes are lined with gorges and waterfalls, and there are many beautiful hiking trails all through the area, and lovely opportunities for artists and photographers. It's also quite a wine growing region now. So it's become more of a tourist destination in recent decades. It's a very nice place to live, lovely.
That's great. And because you're on the lakes, I know that the weather winter can be kind of a little hard up in that part of New York, but around where you guys are, it's a little moderated again, because those lakes are fairly big. So I think it's just wonderful where you are. So that leads me to, natural science illustration, which is how we kind of got connected through this, was looking at why do we do natural science illustration? And I know some people think, well, we could take a photo, but why do we do this instead? Anybody, why are we illustrating rather than just taking photos? Well, how is it helpful?
Well, in some of the work that I do a lot of textbook work, art development for the science textbook market. And a lot of subjects are just not visible. Cell biology, genetics, a lot of it is theoretical. So there has to be ways of communicating science visually for things you cannot see. And then sometimes when you're looking at a bird or an animal or something in the macro world, those details are not evident on some of these animals that you want to highlight. So the illustrations accompany photographs.
And often, go ahead, Stefan.
I was going to say, you know, along the same lines, I think it's important to be able to visualize things that are not often seen with the naked eye. So a lot of the work I do with ichthyographic animals, the fish and stuff like that. So they're underwater. People don't normally see them. And in addition to that, the difference, you know, the advantage to an illustration over a photograph a lot of times is to be able to emphasize certain parts of what you're trying to describe graphically and de-emphasize others. So it's not always possible with photography, and, you know, you're dealing with creatures that are not always readily observable.
I think that's another
thing. Another thing is, I used to do a lot of work with insects, and part of the job of the illustrator is to clean up that insect, which might be covered with dirt or spores or dust, and just get rid of all the extraneous things around there and draw the actual animal in its purity, so to speak.
In the same lines as that, some of the fish specimens you get are not completely intact. They may be damaged. They may be missing fins. Mm-hmm. Some of them may be coming from jars of formalin, and they may be fish that are extinct or extirpated. And it becomes necessary to reconstruct the missing body parts to give a complete visual picture.
You know, another aspect of the work that I do that I'm just all of a sudden thinking of is that a lot of the illustrations are showing a process of mitosis or any of the way, you know, the cells behave or even animal behavior. A lot of it is that sort of illustration where it's not really appropriate just to show a photograph.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I remember, and I think many in our audience will remember, is that if we go back pre-photography, or when photography was really big instruments that were really hard to get into the field, that a lot of that was done where there were multiple, what you're saying, Elizabeth, multiple images, some zoomed in, you were looking at, you know, or different stages of life of in a plant and a seed. We probably all remember going through a botany department and seeing these incredibly beautiful illustrations that showed a lot of things. So in a way, it's like nature journaling a little bit, is the way you're describing it.
Yes, it's one of the most wonderful things to be able to document what's out there in the natural world as far as appearance and life cycles and that kind of thing. But it is, it's a kind of recording and documentation of what's out there in the wild.
Yeah. And I would think it's inherent in what you guys do that you're slowing down, you're taking time, but that also allows, if it's not a specimen, if you're out actually live with something, that allows certain things to appear that you might not see otherwise because you're quiet, you're sitting there, and you're waiting for something. All right. And that something comes out. And even from your specimens, I would think there's an aspect to that your vision about it, what you see, improves the more you look at it to have to illustrate it. Am I right with that?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. You know, when you're studying something, when you're trying to draw something, there's no better way to see the detail of something than when you're trying to draw it. Because that's the right. More you stare at it, the more you focus on it, the more things sort of come into focus. And what comes into focus for me a lot of times with the things that I draw is there's a certain kind of order that you see in what looked random, the way I do a lot of birds, the way the flight feathers lay down in such a lovely way, the pattern of the scales on the feet. All of these things are not evident when you're just glancing at something, but if you're staring at it and you want to draw it and you want to draw it accurately, which is basically what we try to do, then you really start seeing this order. And that's the wonderful thing. That's the kind of thing we're trying to share with people when we make these drawings and show that detail.
That's just Really great. Francis, I think you were going to say something along that line too.
With the illustration. Yeah, go ahead. The importance of just looking and drawing as a way to know things, to a way to know what's there. If you're really trying to capture it on a piece of paper with a pencil, you're looking at every little detail and part and say, oh, I would never have noticed that if I wasn't drawing this. It's such a wonderful way to get to know something.
Yeah. Lucy?
And I'm just thinking about when you're in the field and you're talking about photography versus illustration, we always take photos in the field thinking I'm going to come back and draw it. But you find out the photograph you took doesn't have the details you need. So you really do need to sketch in the field if you want to capture something.
Oh, true.
You can't rely on those photos that you take.
So I think that's really, Lucy, that's a really important point. And I think people forget. So in illustration, you are attempting in your illustrations through shading and shadowing and stuff to create a three-dimensional object. So you're not really in illustration creating a flat object, even though it's in 2D, you're simulating the perspective in the other. However, in the camera, it's still a 2D image. And so I think that's what's really interesting is when you go to try to draw from it, and I've done this too, you try to go from an image that was photographically done, I don't get the shadowing and the depth and I lose that. And so I think you're right, you have to supplement that photograph with an illustration that helps you see more of the detail.
That's right. And sometimes you need to look at many photographs of the same object, either that you've taken or you can go and research the creature, because a lot of the details are in shadow or they're turned away or this, you know, you've got to piece together this organism from lots of different aspects of it.
Seven?
I think sometimes there's a difference, a distinction made depending on what the illustration is being used for. And in my field in ichthyography, we have these dichotomous keys, which are used for identification. And in that case, your illustrations, they do want to be flat, almost one-dimensional, because you're counting fin rays and scales and things like that. So in that case, you're almost taking your observations, your photographs, and you're removing the third dimension. You're getting rid of reflections and shading and stuff like that to simplify it for simple visual identification. On the other hand, those same aspects, if you do an illustration for another purpose, it's not an identification guide, you're actually looking to recreate and enhance counter shading in fish, things that give the appearance of the fish receding and giving it dimension on the paper. When it comes to color, it becomes really an amazing world because you're looking at colors and it's like the others were saying earlier about real intense observation. One of the things I'm constantly reminding myself of is to look and to really look, because you're taking a color and you're kind of deconstructing it. Something that's generally observed as being blue may actually have six or seven colors in it. And so you're deconstructing it and then reconstructing it on paper. So it kind of depends on the application, but you have the opportunity to do all of this. And that makes you a lot more familiar with the subject and their colors and their structure and their shape. It's really an interesting process, and I think worthwhile the efforts of the illustrators.
Yeah, and you know, your description's really good because I think of my field guides, and particularly for birds, but you're talking about aquatic animals, particularly fish, right? What I think is, I always think of that first thing that you do to identify is just a general shape. Illustrators do that for us, right? You know, that it's just a like a silhouette cutout, but that can give us a thing, whether it's a raptor or whether it's something else. I'm sure it's an insect and fish in the same way that we, our first identification. And you're so right, Stefan. You get to where if it's something's oriented in light differently, scales or feathers, they, and on insects particularly, on some of their exoskeleton, right, you get different colorations showing up depending on where the light hits.
Oh, yes.
And that has to be amazing to figure out ways to capture all that.
It's very true. It's very difficult to draw, for example, iridescence, which I was trying to do with this crow illustration I made. When you start looking at different photographs of different birds, particularly blackbirds with black feathers, the colors in the iridescence, and you realize, oh my God, there's purple and there's green and there's this crazy turquoise blue. All of these colors that you, as Stefan was saying, when you start focusing on that, you see that if you're going to draw, paint an iridescent bird, these are the colors that make up that phenomenon. And you learn that because you're staring at it so much.
Recently working on an article for our journal on recreating iridescence in fish, and have been put in a position of researching it and looking for illustration and art techniques that could do that kind of thing, and was able to get the input of several successful illustrators. And it goes back to that idea of deconstructing things. That, you know, at first you might be tempted to take the shortcut and use glitter paints or,
right.
Yeah, and what it really basically comes down to for most illustrators is really looking at the iridescence and seeing, oh, that shiny, it's really got yellows and blues and purples in there. And if you are really able to concentrate and align those and color those areas of contrasting colors up, you'll be able to reproduce the iridescence without using, mica.
Right.
It's concentrated observation.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. And go ahead, Elizabeth.
I was going to say, bringing up a point that he mentioned, Stefan mentioned earlier, about the purpose of the illustration. It could be something that needs to be diagnostic to show the scales on the fish. And what you were saying, Mark, sometimes all you want is that black silhouette because you just want the shapes, and a lot of guidebooks will give you that. And then sometimes you want to create an illustration that is very accurate, but also very beautiful. You want it to be attractive. You want it to be compelling so that the student or whoever is reading the textbook or reading the guide is drawn to it and wants to study it, and then sort of becomes interested and respectful of that animal because it is very appealing in that illustration. So yeah, the purpose of the illustration, depending on the project and the client and who you're working for. And if you're doing work for yourself as a fine art piece, you have more freedom to just express the animal or the plant any way you'd like. So the purpose of it for a scientific illustrator, especially working professionally in the field, is very important.
Yeah, this just makes complete sense. And it's interesting, I was lucky as a young child, I grew up with my best friend's dad was a natural science illustrator and we were in Indiana at that time. It was Outdoor Indiana, the magazine. Cool. And he always had a whole full page every month that he had to illustrate for on a big canvas. Yeah. And that was always set up when I'd go over to his house. And it was my first introduction to watching him work with multiple images, specimens and things around to create these incredibly beautiful, which we've all seen, illustrations, which we still need. That's and so it's amazing to have grown up with that, because I think that's what inspired me to want to do it.
Yeah,
as well.
Back in the old days when everything was traditional media.
Yeah. Stefan?
Going back and touching on a few of the things we were talking about, too, the purpose of the illustration and its intent, is that another thing that illustrating allows you to present to the observer that is are certain occurrences and events that are almost never observable. And it goes beyond your subject matter itself and its appearance. And speaking with fish again too, is you want to illustrate a predator-prey relationship. So you're able to put together different species that are not readily observable in the wild and recreate a moment of action or behavior or something like that. So that goes beyond the it's another aspect of illustration other than identification or, you That's know, other types, but recreate actual events.
Yep.
That's so you're talking, you're talking about really, Stefan, which I think people don't think about with illustrators, and that's the problem-solving aspect. So you talk about deconstructing, you talk about imagination and creativity. You have to somehow be able to represent things that in the medium that you're using. And so you're always solving a problem, it would seem, and which would make it fun. I mean, you're always trying to solve, how do I represent this?
There's a lot of problem solving, right? From your composition to your approach to getting your mediums and materials to do what you would like to have them do.
That's
right. So problem solving is a big part of it.
Yeah. And then not to mention your client and your schedule and your budget and all those real constraints to any
real life problems.
Right. And you want, I always want my compositions to draw people in, to be interesting enough that the person who's looking at it will say, oh, and actually stop and then see what it's about.
Right.
So there's that.
Yes.
Wow factor that I like to get in there.
And in those, along those lines too, and it's true with whether you're doing illustration that's more fine art or more illustrative or whatever, is to within the genre of the artwork, the technique, the materials, is that you're always thinking about how to manipulate the observer's eye to draw it in a certain direction, to make it see something. And that has a lot to do with composition and rendering and stuff. Yep. So you're also thinking about the observer's reaction to it and how their mind is going to perceive it.
You know, that's great, because I think of this all the time, because I like to do things that I guess one might call a poster. So it takes on a theme, and it's sort of a content rich poster. So it's got images, it's got copy. So you have to design the layout in such a way that it flows, that people will read the copy, not too much copy, and it's telling a story. It's a self-contained story. And is that me?
Okay,
that's not me.
Okay, good.
So I think that's a really fun, and it's a fun project. I very much enjoy doing those kinds of compositions, because you get to exercise any skills you may have for graphic design. You get to write the copy. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I this idea of the composition and directing the observer's eye and things like that happens on both sides of your brain. You've got the left side where it's more artistic, and it's like, my eye is going to follow from this, because I generally put a larger amount of space in front of the fish I'm illustrating when I'm not doing a key. And that negative space, that open space in front of it, kind of gives the perception of the fish, the movement, because it's moving into that area. So that's like the left brain stuff. But then, as Elizabeth was saying, we're talking about the posters and stuff like that. There are certain things that are a little more linear on the other side of your brain, where you're, it's got to make sense to your eye, and it's got to go in a certain order. And so when you're composing a life cycle, perhaps, of an insect or something, you've got to make it work that way too. So I also learned in an illustration class I took out in Shoals Marine Laboratory that if you're doing a book, if you're writing a book, you're composing books, particularly textbooks, that graphic design becomes a very important part of not only the illustrations, but the layout of the book itself. So the mind just doesn't go, and drops it, and it's drawn in. And that has a lot to do with more linear type stuff.
And you guys are talking about relying on the brain, which we do in the real world, right? We rely on the brain to do the actual interpretation. So what we actually see with the optical instrument is fundamentally sometimes different than what the brain interprets it to be. It can fill in gaps, it can do things. And you're doing that as an illustrator. In other words, you're trying to get us to look at something in a way and allow our brain to construct part of the illustration, right? I mean, it's funny, the brain can fill in.
Tricks and illusions, smoke and smoke and mirrors.
Lucy, when you're working on your illustrations, what are some of the tricks that you do use to help us to be able to see things differently? So I know perspective is one of them, but what else what are the other things that you might use?
I guess lately I've just been working with some color and I guess bringing up out the color or the contrast in the areas that I feel are more important. That might be some ways to do that.
Do you find yourself, I learned when I went to art school that sometimes you don't want to use black or you don't want to use pure white in a natural illustration. Do you find yourself using those colors?
Lately, I've been working with this drafting film with colored pencil and drafting film.
Wow.
And one of the tricks there is you could actually back paint with white the image that you mm-hmm. colored, and that will make it pop right out of the page. So mm-hmm. Before computer, and I guess before, when illustrations were just done to be copied, could do a lot of things that might not then be visible to the eye once it's photographed. Like if black and white illustrations can be white out, you could use white out and make corrections that way. And so now when we do some of our work for our shows, we're trying to also create something beautiful that could stand alone. So it's not an illustration just for photographic purposes or reproduction purposes. It's for something that could hang on the wall. So whatever tricks you use has to be okay for everyday viewing.
I like what you're saying there, Lucy. And going back to what you were talking about, back painting and doing color pencil on Mylar, your choice of materials and techniques, which you hope to educate yourself from other people's experience and stuff, can make a big difference. There's a huge difference. And I'm always amazed at what can be done with colored pencils. It's like once I grew up, was like, wow, this is the one step away from a crayon, and look at what these people do. And there's honestly, God, there is such a difference in colored pencil that's done on a paper and one that's done on Mylar.
Yeah.
The ones on Mylar are so graphic and stark, and they pop, and tricks that go along with that technique with the back painting and stuff like that to enable that more. It's just, it's great. That whole other area of exploration and technique and materials. So, I think you're right with that, Luce.
That's great. I've been talking with Elizabeth Morales, Lucille Francis Gagliardo, and Stephen DiCerbo, and I'm sorry, I'm probably butchered that, but DiCerbo and Francis Fawcett, about natural science illustration. And particularly, we've been talking about how the techniques that we might use, the way we help people get drawn into a picture. And we'll be right back.
This is Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're talking about natural science illustration. And I was curious, what got this started was you guys had recently done an exhibition in the Finger Lakes area. Who'd like to go and kind of describe that exhibition to us?
Lucy, since you put it together, you should.
Hi. Yep.
There you go.
I'm involved with the exhibit committee. And the title of the show was Our Capacity for Wonder. Our Capacity for Wonder, which I got from a John Green writing, and what he was describing was his son looking at a leaf that just was a to him a just a a brown leaf that had nothing interesting until John, the dad, was looking very, very closely and saw all the little colors and the veins and how one brown leaf was just so much more. And so I thought that is exactly what we do all the time. But I want to make that the focus of the exhibit. So all our artists did artwork that expressed that for them.
So you gave I'm assuming then you gave the artist kind of a theme around wonder. And were they able to bring works that they'd done previously that fit the theme as well as new works, or was this all new works?
Some people had some older works, but pretty recent work.
Okay.
And it was quite a broad theme. We have artists who want to do more botanical and some like animals. And so we wanted a theme that could cover everything. And and they always do a great job coming through at the very end with pieces right at the last minute. We're a great group.
How many pieces were in the show? Oops. You know, approximately, any of you?
Let's see. There were how many artists, Lucy? About 20?
There were 20. Okay. Up to 60 pieces. There might have been 60 pieces.
That's a really big show, and you know, by any scale, and that's a lot for you all to curate. And so, you know, deciding on the sizes and where they are, and I assume that you had all different kinds of size ranges, from very small to large. You have to figure out how to hang all that. As a former museum person myself, I can identify with the challenges beyond getting the works. Or then how do you display that? And I assume it was really well received. What do you think the takeaways were from people that came to the show? Did you get a sense of what they were thinking, feeling? How did this affect them?
You know, I think this was our third annual show at the conservatory. And I think that the people who come, especially for the opening, they come because the work is accessible. It's a lot of kids come, teenagers and so forth. It's not a fine art show where they may feel like they're not sure what they're looking at and want to help somebody to help them interpret abstract pieces or that sort of thing. It's a show where they're guaranteed to be able to recognize many of the creatures, plants, animals, and microorganisms. And if they can't, the descriptions will help them. So I think it's because it's about nature. I think it has that sort of friendly, approachable, like, you know, people say, yeah, I want to see that show. It's probably going to be great.
Any other impressions? What were your impressions when you saw all of you, when you saw that show?
I was very proud. I thought it was a fantastic show. Our people, our chapter group, the artists in our group are just fabulous, amazing, amazing artists.
Wow.
I'd like to say, you know, I'm a little more removed than some of my contemporaries here, like Lucy and Elizabeth, and less involved than they are in curating or putting the show together. But just, you know, a couple points, Lucy's choice in the description of it, capacity for wonder. I mean, as a participating illustrator and stuff, that touches home. I can remember, you know, being a child of 5 or 6, like Lucy was talking about the person with the leaf. I can remember laying prone in my backyard in the grass and just focusing on a square foot area of the grass and watching all the activity, the ants, the animals in this macro environment. And, you know, it was just fascinated by that. And the early beginnings of being able to focus on something like that, but you know, really the capacity for wonder is a great description for it. And I have to say, Lucy's probably one of the best facilitators and organizers that I've ever run across, and she's helped me out a lot too in interfacing with the group. And I appreciate the work that all of you guys do.
Thank you, Stephen.
I think, you know, one of the other things that I wonder about, and when you're doing something like that, you're asking the artists to step out of probably what they're doing normally in a certain way. Although some of them may do that, and you talk about doing things for your own pleasure. But this one is one where you really were doing it for the public viewing, and a different kind of public than maybe what you would get in a science illustration. So how did that affect you as artists? I assume that each of you had some works maybe in it, but what was that like, Frances?
Now I can speak to that because the piece I had in there, which had six microorganisms, algae specifically, that you might find in a drop of pond water. I created it specifically for, I put it together from the microorganisms that were created for another purpose, but I put them together in this drop of pond water that you might actually see if you looked through a microscope, if you were lucky enough to get them all in the same drop. You might actually see it. So I put it together as if it were a fine art piece in a way. It was a lot of fun. I truly enjoyed it. It seems when we first hear about these shows, oh no, I've got to think of a piece for this show. But once you get into it, once you start doing it, it's so much fun. And it's got that whole puzzle aspect to it.
Yeah.
All the different parts of researching each creature to see if their sizes would correspond to each other. And it was great.
Yeah. I feel the same way. Because most of my work is more scientifically oriented, more the so-called hard sciences. When I do pieces for any of our shows, these large format pieces that are going to hang in the gallery, I have a complete freedom to do whatever I want. It's not for a client, it's for me. So I always have a list of things that I have wanted to do. And when I have the push from the show, you know, all of a sudden I say, okay, I can do one of these things that I've been thinking about doing because it's so different from anything else I do. Was it two years ago, Lucy, when we had the Mann Library at Cornell? We had a show at one of the library gallery space at Cornell. And that show was more scientifically oriented. We were talking a little bit more about what we were mentioning earlier, the collaboration between artist and scientist. And that show, I was able to show pieces that I actually did or something similar for a book or a journal, because that was a more scientific illustration, the hard sciences. Yeah. But most of our shows are more fine art oriented, and we're able to, you know, be able to have a little more freedom in terms of the layouts and so forth.
Yeah, and I would assume you have some more freedom in abstraction as well. And so you can play around a little more with it, that not having to be as scientifically accurate as the work.
Right. Well, it should be accurate, but it can be, you can be a little bit looser with the interpretation, but it still is a scientific.
Still a scientific illustration, right.
And this is something I really appreciate with the group and these shows too, is because my work, a lot of it, although I do, tight, illustrations with pen and ink and colored pencil and pen and ink and wash too. I branch off in other areas that may fairly well approach fine art, but the fact that they're nature related and, you know, we can do all the wonderful things you can do with illustrations too, still makes them relevant. And the pieces that I had in this show were Gyutaku pieces, which as a printmaker, I also do etchings and things like that, but I've learned the technique and developed the technique for Japanese fish printing, which is what Gyutaku is. And the Japanese propensity for the love of nature and reproduction, and even though this evolved out of a fisherman's way to record their catch, is just stunning. And a way to record things that crosses a line or goes both into illustration and photography, because the fish in the images are printed directly from an actual fish. And sometimes you pick up amazing scale detail and things like that, and then you progress it forward by adding colors and stuff. So the ability to do those images and put these in these shows is, you know, like pushing, you know, some of the boundaries or the envelopes and crossing over lines. And I have a lot of fun with that. And the pieces I had down there were in the opposite of some of the macro pieces and stuff with people, I was going for size. I had some very large pieces that Lucy had to handle for me. Some of them 6 foot in length, with 9 or 11 fish in a school. And yeah, it was a lot of fun that way. So the freedom to loosen up and do things that are not tightly scientifically identifiable, you know, is really appreciated. So
you made a really good point, Stefan, and I hadn't really thought about it, but one of the real challenges I think all of you face is scaling something. In other words, how do you define what size it's going to be? So if somebody, somebody goes, you got a 6 foot by 9 foot canvas. Well, you know, okay, how big are my fish going to be? How many are going to be in there? Or how, you know, so you're talking about using the brain spatially in ways that maybe none of us really think about with art. We think, oh, it's just present, you draw, but you have to figure out what's the context on that canvas it's going to be. How are you going to compose that, in a sense, that mm-hmm. scene? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Frances?
It makes a huge difference in an illustration, in a fine art piece particularly, what size you print it at, or you, if it's going to be something that's done in traditional media, what size you set up your canvas to be to begin with. I come from a fine art background. Many of my friends here come from a science background. My original background is fine art, and I love to work big. So I'm always thinking, what will the impact of this be at a large size compared to if you just saw it as a small thing? And yes, often it just makes a huge difference to just expand it so that it becomes more of the viewer's world. There, mm-hmm. It's hard to describe, but it makes a big difference. And I love to do work where you feel like you can enter right into the yes. environment that you're creating.
Yep, yep.
And that a lot depends on the scale there.
I agree.
And as you're working with scale too, Mark, as you mentioned, composition becomes a big part of it. And things like the use of negative space, you know, Robert Bateman was somebody that I was always impressed, a well-known wildlife artist that passed several decades. And his use of negative space goes a long way in helping you direct the observer's eye in certain and creating motion and action. And, you know, some of the things that I utilize with my pieces is, you know, perhaps fish number two is not entirely on the canvas, he's entering from the margins, or having this excessive space in front of them, which imparts a feeling of motion because there's an open area for them to head to. And a lot of that comes in along with the scale, whether it's large or small, it's how you put it together, how the parts of the image relate to each other, and actually the areas where there is no image, a negative space. So it's a part of the puzzle.
Yeah. You know, I work because of my years of working in the textbook industry, everything I've created, either traditional media or digital, fits on an 8.5 by 11 page. So there's only a certain amount of detail that's allowable at that size. So when I do these pieces for our shows, like especially this one poster I did called Wild City, it has, I don't know, 10, at least 10 water birds, herons and so forth, egrets. I made it really large because then I could get the detail in each bird. I could get the wing, I even did them like twice the size that they appear in the poster, because I had the ability to go large and get everything I wanted into this poster and also show the detail. So it's great for me because everything I've always done has been quite small.
You know, that's a really good point. And I hadn't really thought about it that way. But, you know, one of the things we do to get things down quick, if particularly like in theater or in filming or whatever, is we do thumbnails.
Right.
They have very little detail. They're very fast sketches, but they can give the impression of more because you can't really look that closely.
That's true.
And you're right, Elizabeth, when you all of a sudden have to scale it up, you're able to get way more detail in there because you're working at a scale of the actual medium you're working with, whether it's chalk or pencil or whatever, or paint, you're able to get more stroke into that than you can in the other. Francis?
I got to say, though, thumbnails are just invaluable. You can get that basic draw in or wow factor right in that thumbnail and think, this is the composition I want for my big piece. I want it to have this, the dark here, the light here, the diagonals going this way. Absolutely. Because,
I agree. I always do small sketches for layout because the layout is critical to the whole piece. Also, it reminds me, though, of some of our people. I don't do this, and I admire those who can, but when they do field sketching, they're sitting out in somebody's yard, and they're doing essentially their thumbnails of what is in front of them. And some of them put in washes, some watercolor wash.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And they look fantastic, and they're done in 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's the beauty of that. And I would think when you're in the field, you know, you guys were talking about trying to record, that's invaluable. Because you're not trying to make a completed piece in the field.
No.
Lucy?
Well, one thing I encouraged our artists to do for the show was to include some of their sketchbooks. Because I wanted the people who came to the show to see not only stages that some of our artists go through to create their work, but to see how nice just doing quick sketches feels and how you capture more motion sometimes in those field sketches than you do in the final piece.
That's really great. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and the public to have conversations like we're having today. We encourage you to have conversations at home about what we've been talking about, sitting around your table or wherever you are, and to think about how art and science are interrelated. And we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling. We just had the most exciting conversation about a natural science illustration, but beyond that, how people that do science illustration got an opportunity to work in more of a fine arts medium for the show. It still was with the science. And I was talking with Elizabeth and Lucille and Stefan and Francis about the idea of visual language, how we communicate, how we draw a person in. Stefan did a really great job of that. But I was really curious, because this has been kind of my theme for the last part of the last 10 years, was this idea of what is a true collaboration between a scientist and an illustrator? And I think that often what happens is it's easy for us to understand that a scientist wants a picture of something and they ask an illustrator to draw it. But I don't find that a collaboration, and or vice versa. The illustrator wants just some of the science to be able to have as the subject. But they get that from the scientist, but I don't think that's a collaboration. So when it really is happening, and I know Elizabeth, you and I have had conversations around this, there is a big difference when you actually are collaborating. And can you guys describe what that means when you and the scientist are really going back and forth? Yeah, Francis.
I've been fortunate the last 4 or 5 years I had the opportunity to work with in two different projects, one with an ecologist who works with milkweed and monarchs, and one with a entomologist who works with solitary bees. Both of them were doing books and asked me to do the illustration work on the books. And both situations were so interesting and fun because they would come to me with a problem, with a desire to show something and ask for my help in figuring out what the best way to show it would be. And then we would go back and forth with sketches and the science, and does this show exactly what you want? And it made me feel like I was really part of the of the science endeavor to bring this book that had a theme. Both books had wonderful themes. It just made me feel like I was doing something very valuable.
I love that, because what you're talking about, particularly in that one, is that what you're doing is both of you are learning from one another.
Yes.
And so you're having to learn some of the science to be able to do the illustration in the right way. Yes. And they're having to understand what you're capable of reproducing. Right. And that, I think, that becomes a collaboration. It doesn't mean the scientist has to draw, but I think they have to get into your world and you have to get into their world.
That's right.
Others? Yes. Other thoughts on that?
Again, because I do textbooks over the years, I would do the art development for the whole book. So what that means is you work with the author or authors, and not only are you developing from their text, you're together with the authors, you're developing, you're deciding which illustrations in the chapter need to be illustrated to make it more understandable to the student. And then you have to develop a sort of an evolution of the illustrations through that chapter. So there's a logical progression that the information unfolds visually, so the student is able to then follow the text and follow with the illustrations. So this collaboration is a bookwide process. So it gets very complicated to have that continuity, visual continuity through the entire book. Authors are often completely at a loss in terms of how to do this visually. So that's why the art development of these books is so important. And I've always enjoyed working with authors who ask for that help, don't feel like they know what they want and this is how they're going to show it. You know, they're not trying to do my job. They let me do that part of the job of what I know about. And those have always been wonderful projects to work on with authors.
Wow. Do any of you get insights from that, from the conversation that you have with the scientists that you're working with? And so I know some of you sometimes are the scientists as well, but do you get insights into how you might do your work differently?
Well, I learn a lot from the authors when they're describing what needs to be shown. I'm constantly learning new things. And I do a lot of introductory biology textbooks. So there's a chapter on everything in those books. And I learn a tremendous amount. I mean, at that level of understanding, I learn a lot. And I learn that often learn that I'm showing something incorrectly. And this is why. And so it is a two-way thing.
Do you get any pushback? You know, I always wonder about people, I think in general, have a misunderstanding about the amount of hours that go into a piece and the compensation for that. Do you get any of that pushback? I assume you do. You're laughing.
Absolutely.
So that you get some pushback. It can't cost that much to do this.
Well, I'll tell you, going from traditional media to digital, I work 100% digitally.
Okay.
Almost 100%. For myself, sometimes not. But that has been a real time saver, because in the old days, you'd do a painting with airbrush and all of the hours of putting together a piece of art, and then there are changes requested. It'd be a nightmare. But now, when I work digitally, changes are so much faster. So that has helped.
You know, I believe even in the areas that I work in that are closer to the fine art, edge of the coin, and for instance, this printmaking process called Gyutaku that I mentioned, is people are enthralled with it, they like it, and then they're mystified, but they don't have any concept of what goes into it. And part of what I do is to try to educate them not only to the history of it, cultural implications, but the process and technique that I've developed. And when I start listing out all the steps to the process, they're like blown away. And it's like, so now you understand. And it can be time consuming, or, you know, very time consuming. But I think part of what we do is to make complicated things look simple. And I tell them, if there's a way for me to complicate my own process, I seem to be able to find it.
I love that. The thing that comes to mind also with me with thinking about this stuff is And I used to get this, I was an exhibit designer in a museum, and you'd get this idea that somebody said, oh, that must be a really fun job. And I'd say, yes, but the emphasis was on job. that, you know, they somehow think that artists are having a lot of fun, and we do have fun, but we have to put that in a context that there are real problems we're solving, real frustrations with you know, being paid, real frustrations with making deadlines, having reasonable things happen, trying to work the problems out. And so, yes, I would say that, and I'd like each one of you to think about what, how would you respond to somebody say, well, that's a really fun job. any thoughts on that one?
I would say it's a really, it's a very satisfying job.
There you go.
A sense of satisfaction when you can create an illustration or a book, and you've worked well with your author and your editors, and everybody's happy, and you get thank you letters from your authors. That's fantastic. But it's hard work. It's hard work. And it takes a lot of research and doing a lot of homework and that collaboration, the back and forth. You have to be able to take criticism from authors. If they don't like something, you have to say, oh, fine, I'll redo it, and, you know, and tell me why and so forth. So I would say it's fun sometimes. It's challenging most of the time, but it's very satisfying.
I think part of that satisfaction has to come from within too. Despite accolades and people being satisfied with your work, it's part of it is being in love with the learning process. So what you've learned in doing this piece, what you've learned in the process of supporting doing this piece, it's satisfaction expanding your own knowledge base. And if you like the learning process, you'll get a lot more from the personal level on this too.
Yep, absolutely.
That's true.
Excellently said.
Yeah, that's perfect. And I think it is, you're right. It's the personal growth. And one of the things is that none of you are experts in anything in particular, even in the art medium. And so that's what's great about that is it's allowing you to keep exploring different medium, different subjects, different. And I think that would be where I would find a lot of enjoyment, was that I'm constantly learning something new. Yeah. Oh, this day, you know, one day I'm illustrating fish, but maybe another day I'm illustrating a plant, or I'm doing something else. And it just, I think, and you have different people in your lives. So I think you're right. All of you, you get your pleasure and you get satisfaction. I love that word for this, out of being there. But it's also rewarding, and as it would be with any other job, and people forget about that part of it.
Well, I mean, and part of our job generally as an organization is science education. that's our mission and so that's also an area where we get great satisfaction, is that we're pushing forward the education of science.
I think the coin flips too. You get a lot from the learning process and expanding your knowledge, but a lot of us also turn around and teach workshops or through the product that we make, expand the learning process for other people too. So,
yeah, and I think we forget about what both of you are saying. I think we forget that our artists, in this case with natural science illustration, are both what you were saying, science educators, but I think we're also science communicators.
Yeah.
So that's one of the weaknesses of our training of some of our scientists, is it's very difficult for them when they're embedded in that they are experts in something to be able to say that to the public, or to be able to do that. And you guys really become that interpreter, right? Between the science and the public.
Right. That's right. We're visually communicating what the scientist is writing about.
It's just so great.
I was saying we are visual creatures too. There's so much more that can be done with an illustration or a picture than a written word.
I agree. I want to thank our guests, Elizabeth Morales, Lucille Francis Gagliaro, and Stephen DiCerbo, and Francis Fawcett. And I want to encourage all of you to get a sketchbook and to go out and to sit somewhere quiet, even if it's for 15 or 20 minutes, and I don't care how great you think you are as an artist, and begin sketching, because I think you will find that you'll see the world differently. And until next time, we hope that you'll explore more curiosities at the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.